You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Our first talk of the day is joining the Blue Dots. We're going to have Joanne Preston coming to the stage. She has been to Greenbelt before, but has never spoken before. So first time, very exciting. I will just mention a few things about who she is. So she's an expert in coastal restoration ecology, and she's a marine biologist at the Institute of Marine Sciences in Portsmouth, the University of Portsmouth. She's also the scientific lead for Europe's first large seascape restoration project, and that is called the Solent Seascape Project. She's going to be talking about our relationship with the seas and how that fits in with our climate goals. Let's give her a massive round of applause as she comes to the stage.
Thank you very much. Yeah, my name's Jo. I'm a professor of marine biology based at the University of Portsmouth, but I work all the way around the temperate world, which is the non-tropical, the non-polar regions, working in habitat restoration. I do science that informs the policy and practice of restoration. Now, over the last few years, we've started to really understand that the way we relate to science, the way we relate to nature, is having a huge impact on how we restore it. So today I want to take you on a journey underwater. Okay, this is a brilliant addition to your spiritual morning. Nothing better on a Sunday morning but marine biology to calm the nerves and soothe the soul. I'm going to tell you about the forgotten marine ecosystems, the things you don't even know existed, and what that means for our humanity's goals of sustainable development, climate change mitigation, and biodiversity. I want you to feel what you've lost, but it's not going to stop at ecological grief. I'm going to take you on a story of hope and community, and where I think we need to change and radically shift and create bold action to achieve what we need to achieve if humans are going to survive and then thrive on this planet. So, a couple of housekeeping. This is an idea of my friend Claire. If I use a word that does not resonate with normal conversation, just put your hand up, because I think I've sort of taken out most of the technical terms, but sometimes I miss them. So please do that. Secondly, everything I say is in papers I've published. So all the evidence is out there. If you want it, it's there. Thirdly, I'm going to have some interaction for introverts. Here is a code for Nearpod. Near as in not far, and pod as in podcast. And if you sign in using this code, if you have any reception, there's a big if, just some pictures will pop up throughout the talk. And it's self-led, and I'll tell you when a picture might pop up. You have to scan to it. This is just to help with some visuals, but I'll describe them, so if you don't have them, that doesn't matter. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to talk about how our relationship with nature has changed and why that matters. And then I'm going to tell you about these habitats that we've lost. But I'm not going to be talking about the tropical ones, not the coral reefs, not the mangroves. I'm talking about the nature on our doorstep, the nature in Europe. We often absolve our responsibility and our conservation and action away abroad. But how we act here is really fundamental. Then I'm going to show how our relationship with that nature really impacts how we do or don't solve these crises and how it's dependent on connectivity. Connectivity is a major theme in my talk today. And then we're going to some solutions. So, quick question. Who's familiar with the triple planetary crisis? Hands up. Some people, not as many as I'd thought. So the triple planetary crisis is the intertwined phenomenon of climate change crisis, pollution crisis, anthropogenic impacts, harmful substances going into our world, and biodiversity lost. It was coined by Antonio Guterres in 2020 when he addressed the World Forum of Democracy. And that was when we were facing a pandemic. And the importance of this triple crisis is that it said alongside the pandemic, we face this triple planetary emergency. And what you understand by this talk is how entwined these are. And therefore, if we stop, we need to stop this delineated, separate thinking, and we need to approach this crisis in a connected way. So, first of all, we're going to go to the sea. Okay, so most of us love living by the sea. We go love going on holiday in the sea. In fact, pretty much 40% of the world's population live by the sea. That's because they're abundant, there's life, there's fish, there are routes for trade. However, 87% of all marine biomes, biomes just a thing you can observe in nature, like a tundra or a forest or a mangrove, 87% of all biomes are affected by overfishing, habitat loss and pollution. There is almost no marine wilderness left in the true sense of the word. And that's a stark, stark statement. And this is true in temperate regions, UK, Europe, North America, Australia, South America, more than anywhere else. We have decimated our nature over the last 200 years, decimated it. But it was only a few hundred years ago we thought the seas were inexhaustible. We thought that fish were inexhaustible. Just imagine how abundant something must seem if those that are leading fisheries management thought it was inexhaustible. Just want you to think about that. There's a quote from 1888 by T.H. Huxley. "I believe then that the cod fishery and probably all the great sea fisheries are inexhaustible. That is to say, nothing we do seriously affects the number of fish, and any attempt to regulate fisheries seems useless." Of course, we've learned that that's not true, and we've exhausted so many of our fisheries. Now, the reason why we don't really feel this or know this is because a lot of this decline happened before scientific records began. So we need to take a historical perspective. We need to go back to the 15th century to now to really get a feel for what we've lost. Now, why does this matter? It's because all of us suffer from this sliding baseline syndrome. We were all born with it. And this is the general shift, generational amnesia of what you think pristine and wild is. As the memories of generations that seen a more abundant world are lost with their life, what we see now we think is nature, what we think is wildness. And if we are protecting and thinking that a degraded baseline is nature, we will never achieve our goals. So I'm going to reset your baseline today, hopefully. So first of all, we're going to go to the sea and we're going to go to the middle of the Atlantic and we're going to look about the Atlantic food web. So if you are on Nearpod, the first slide is 81 balls connected by thousands of string. And that's all the animals makes a food web of the Atlantic. The bottom is the algae, the plants, the single-celled algae. And at the top, number 81, guess who they are? Us. And all the red lines, if you can see it, that's just predation on fish. Now, when people talk about ecological resilience and biodiversity, what do they mean? Remember these 81 balls, all connected by thousands of threads. Every single ball is connected to lots of other balls. The more threads you have, that's ecological resilience. That's all it is. The more balls you have, it's biodiversity. How the balls and threads move together, that's ecosystem functioning. That's what ecology is. That's the basket of life. Now, if you pulled any of these, one of these balls, the other ones jiggle and move a bit. If you wanted to cut a few threads, it doesn't matter. There's so many threads. Cut too many threads, you get a pile of balls on the floor. That's ecological collapse. Okay. Now we're going to go to kelp. Kelp is beautiful. If you've got the Nearpod thing, you'll see a picture of lovely, big fronds of green stuff. Now, kelp are massive algal plants, macroalgae, we like to call them. And in between the plants, you get lobsters and sea urchins and crabs, and they like to just graze on the kelp. And then you get, or did get, the sea otters, the sea mink, the sea cows, the whales eating the things that are eating the urchins and the kelp, and you get loads of cod. That's the web of kelp. Unfortunately, we've lost a huge amount of kelp, and it's degrading or being lost at 2% a year. And of what remains, 60% is in poor condition. Now, I want to talk about Stella's sea cow and the sheephead. If you've got the pictures, you'll see this. Anyone know what a dugong is? Yep. So it's like a sort of floating sealy cow, and they're around 3 meters long. They're very cute, and they eat seagrass. They're adorable. They look like marine cows. The sea cow was a dugong on steroids. It was 9 meters long, around 10 tons, and used to be all around the North Pacific Rim and the Gulf of Maine, until Aboriginal hunters hunted most of them out for their lovely fur. And then the Europeans colonized North America, and the fur traders saw these benign, floating, sort of massive beasts of the sea, and we just, 27 years later, after Europeans got there, killed the last Stella's sea cow. So they weren't eating the kelp anymore. And then they moved on to the sea mink and the sea otters. The sea mink was made extinct in 1894. No longer exists. The sea mink used to eat the urchins that would eat the kelp. But it's fine, the otters were still there. But we hunted them to almost extinction. So not so many people, animals eating the urchins. It's fine, the cod are still there. They love urchins. They're voracious eaters of urchins. Then we overfished the cod. The cod population collapsed, and then the kelp collapsed because the urchins ate all the kelp. So that's when you go from an ecosystem to no ecosystem. But all is not lost. With kelp, if you manage it, and at the top of this food chain are the whales, the killer whales. And management of the killer whales, the cod populations, and protection of the otters means that those kelps have bounced back in a lot of places. In the UK, we have some kelp, but we've lost 90% of all kelp in the south of England. Gone. So, if you are watching on Nearpod, there's a circular spectrum of how you preserve our seascapes. But we're going to go onto salt marsh. We're going to come out of the kelp. We're going to go up to the shore. We're going to go and look at the salt marsh. This is a magical place where land meets sea. It's a hinterland. It's mystical. There's so much art and poetry around salt marsh. You probably have seen salt marsh. It's just salt-tolerant plants with lots of channels and creeks between them. These are powerhouses of storing carbon. It's where fish go to junior school, basically. They're really important places for removing nutrients. But globally, we've lost half of all salt marsh. In the UK, 90% of salt marsh is gone, and almost all salt marsh that remains is in unfavourable condition. And we're losing it 100 hectares a year. I have to look down for the facts. Can't remember them all. It's a bit sad. But let's go under the water. Let's go and see the seagrass. Seagrass is the sexy temperate habitat. It's the one that all the cool marine biologists study. That's not me, but it's where you see the really charismatic sharks and seahorses and pipefish. It's really good photography, sand, green, seahorses. It's very charismatic as far as vegetated underwater habitat goes. And seagrass, we've lost around between 40 and 90% of all seagrass in the UK. Now, the thing about seagrass, the seagrass is sort of like the infant school for fish. Okay, it's where they really go to sort of like when they're very little, a bit scared to be safe and feed. And so with that loss of seagrass, we've estimated we've lost 40 million fish and not stored 11 million tons of carbon. It matters. Now, the thing about seagrass, it's like the canary in the mine. It's the sentinel. And it died off in the 1940s to now. There's been huge die-off of seagrass in Australia, in the Gulf of Maine, the Gulf of Mexico, and some in the UK. Some areas it's coming back as well. And that's because, like, the water's getting murky. It's murky. There's lots of sediment. The light can't get through. Why does that matter? Seagrasses are photosynthetic plants. They need light. Convert that magic of converting the sun into sugar, into growth, that is the basis of all food chains. But they need clearer water to thrive. Why is the water not clear? When you go to the estuaries, when you go to the Solent or Essex, and you look at the seas, look at the North Sea, you probably think that's the way it's meant to be. It's not. It's not the way it used to be. What you're looking at is an altered state, a degraded baseline. And I'm going to tell you a little bit why that is and how it used to be. So now we go to the oysters, the oyster reefs. Who's heard of an oyster reef? Oh, it's more than I thought. That's great. So oysters are bivalves, filterers. They look a bit like a stone. They just sit there and they pump water and they eat all the algae in the water. And they settle on top of each other and they create these ecosystems. And on these oysters grow all sorts of things. Algae, mussels settle on them. You get bryozoans, sponges, sea squirts. And then the shrimps and the crabs come and eat those. And then the mid-sized fish come and eat those. And then the big sharks and rays come and eat those. And the birds come out and the seas out. And they are these incredible hotspots of biodiversity. But 85% of all reefs have gone globally. In Europe, 99.9% of oyster reefs have gone. Just we've ate them all. We've fished them out. So I just want to show you what it used to be like. And I'm going to have a few quotes. So me and some others, we took... There's no point going to scientific records. There's no data there. And when we started restoring oyster reefs, I thought, you're mad. They don't occur as reefs. There's just a few oysters in the seabed. That's not how they live. Regulators thought we were making it all up. We weren't, because I knew by the way that they reproduce, this couldn't be true. So we took around 1,600 historical accounts and went through them all and looked for accounts of how these oysters used to live, where they used to live, how they used to be. And I'm going to just give you a couple of quotes. This is from a journal someone kept in 1791 in the Isle of Man. Shellfish, lobsters, crabs, prawns, scallops, razorfish, sea crawfish, don't know what they are, limpets and oysters, of which there is a noble bank or bed betwixt Laxey Bay and Moorhold Head, extending 2 miles in length and 2 in depth. This is from 1875. I understand there is an enormous oyster bed in the North Sea, east of the Silver Pits, in 27 fathoms, that's 30 metres deep, nearly 80 miles long and 25 miles wide. The troilers avoid this rough ground, as they call it, as much as possible. But when they do accidentally get onto it, the oysters are so numerous, they can bring down the vessel. There used to be oyster beds in the Plym and Cattlewater Harbour. They used to be abundant, but they're no more. The failure of the Cattlewater beds is attributed to overdredging and the refuse from the China clay works pouring down the river and choking the beds. The famous Forth of Firth oysters are practically extinct. In the sea lochs of the Scottish west coast, oyster shells were abundant, but scarcely a living oyster exists anymore. Why does that really matter? We used to have oyster reefs that, as a conservative estimate, covered 1.7 million hectares of the seabed just around the UK and North Sea. It would have supported trillions of fish. It would have taken so many nutrients from the water, it would not be the same it is today. And this is true all around Australia and Chesapeake Bay. So that put it in perspective, it's around 47 Isle of Wights, 11 times the size of London. And that's when we had already started overfishing. Now, in Chesapeake Bay, the oysters and all around Australia were put on maritime maps as a navigational hazard. That's how abundant they were. The amount of oysters there could have cleared the whole of the water of Chesapeake Bay in 3 days. Now it'd take a year and a half. And so we've gone from a shift of this bottom system that controlled the water quality to just now loads and loads of phytoplankton and sediment in the water. A massive shift. So now I hope you've sort of got a little bit of a reset of your sliding baseline. Now, why does this really matter? We're all fine, aren't we? We're cracking on. We've got enough food to eat, I think. We've got things to build our houses with. But that's because nature is just clinging on. Those balls and those threads are about to collapse. And the reason why we need to restore these coastal habitats is because the things they provide, the ecosystem services, that's what we call them, are the things that enable our planet to be inhabitable. It's the only thing that humans depend on for our survival. It produces our climate, it regulates our climate, produces all of our food, it protects our coasts. We are nothing without nature because we are nature. And that's a really important thing to understand. And have everyone heard of nature-based solutions? Yep. So using nature to mitigate climate crisis, to put back biodiversity. And these nature-based solutions are entirely dependent on the ecosystem services that these habitats are providing. That's why we want to restore nature. We want to restore the filtration engines. We want to restore the climate mitigation. We want to restore the food webs. And the ocean is such a powerful ally in this. Yet, at the moment, we know that the nature-based solutions could mitigate 30% of all emissions to reach Paris targets. 37%. That's, you know, not, you know, 40% could be solved by nature-based solutions. And yet we don't fund it. There's a massive funding gap of around £500 billion a year. And of that, only 9% ever goes to marine systems. Yet marine systems, and particularly coastal habitats, occupy 0.2% of the seabed, but are responsible for 50% of all carbon drawdown. So something's going a bit wonky. So it is essential that we restore these habitats at massive scales if we are going to achieve our sustainable development goals, reach our Paris climate targets, and reach our coming Montreal biodiversity global framework target. And I want to tell you what that target is and how and why we need radical action if we're going to get to it. So the global biodiversity framework, which is weaves through into the nature restoration law and now the new environment improvement plan in the UK, is to ensure by 2030 at least 30% of areas of terrestrial, inland water and coastal marine systems are under effective restoration in order to enhance biodiversity, ecosystem services, ecological integrity and interconnectivity. So how do we do that? How do we do effective restoration? So I said at the beginning that my work is all about connecting people, connecting knowledge and thinking about how nature works. For too long, we have looked at nature as delineated binary sections of things. Even now we talk about salt marsh or seagrass or mangroves or mud or oysters. Not many people talk about oysters, I do a lot. But they doesn't work like that. I spent the last 2 years looking for all the evidence of how these habitats are connected. And so until we start regulating and restoring nature as nature is, which is connected by in the sea, a body of water through which living things, matter and energy flow. Until we start restoring like that and managing like that, conserving like that, we're not going to do effective restoration. This connectivity is the basis for all food webs and all ecosystem functioning. So my work is about bringing people together that are really good at oyster restoration or salt marsh or seagrass and bring them together and starting to think about how we need to lobby politicians, how we need to write the guidance, and how we need to think that we can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. You can't restore seagrass if you're not thinking about everything around the seagrass. You don't even restore seagrass first. You want to restore the oyster reefs. So they filter the water and the seagrasses will just grow back. So this is a really important shift in understanding. So I'm a huge advocate for what's called seascape restoration, which is the restoration of multiple habitats, either sequentially at the same time, to restore that functionality and the flows between them. And this is not just a gimmicky word. This is a different understanding of the concept that coastal ecosystems are dynamic and heterogeneous and were these huge, vibrant, bold, expansive, yes, heterogeneous, not homogeneous. So it's not all the same thing, lots of different habitats. Thank you very much. You know, and there's a flow of things between them all. And that's the only way that we will have effective restoration, by restoring these flows between them. So what do I mean by that? I'm going to give you examples of the beautiful connectivity across our coastal habitats. And this is still true when we've lost 99% of oyster reefs, 90% of salt marsh, at least 50% of seagrasses in the UK, half of all our kelp. Nature is still reaching and out and connecting, but it's struggling. When you have more than one habitat, it solves coastal protection because they all increasingly stop the waves. When you have sediment going between the habitats, you get much more storage of carbon. And in fact, even the way we do carbon credits is completely nonsense, but that's another talk, because it's not based on the way that carbon flows. The movement of animals. Just think about children. You don't send children straight to work in the city. First of all, they go to nursery, maybe, or homeschooled, and then they go to junior school or infant school, normally infant school first. Then they go to secondary school, they might go to university, and eventually go off into the wide, big world. And they're resilient and tough enough and equipped to do that. Fish are the same. All those coastal habitats are the infant school, the nursery, the junior school, the secondary schools, before they go offshore and support all the offshore fisheries. And that only happens if they've got lots of different habitats to go between, because different habitats are the different schools. Things like a bit of seaweed or kelp flowing between the habitats is how food chains are enhanced. There used to be, when the land was forested in Europe, loads of trees would go into the sea. And that was a really big part of how our ecosystem worked. But the movement of algae in between different places becomes a foundation of whole fish populations and increases nutrients for growth for seagrasses things. And then all the filter feeders, the oysters, the mussels, when they're filtering, you get far more carbon storage and sequestration by all the vegetative plants. So a connected and restored seascape at huge scales is what we need. And that's what will achieve many of our sustainable development goals. It will mitigate the climate and it will be a powerhouse for biodiversity. So, what do we do about it? I've got a few suggestions before I finish. Restoring nature is not rocket science. We know how to do it. It's just the will. We've put men on the moon. We can plant some seagrass. We can build some oyster reefs. Come on, guys, we can do it. But first of all, we need to organise. And we need to create powerful, effective, purpose-driven communities that are connected to politicians and governance structures to change policy that reflects the way that nature works and reset some ambitions. And this works. I set up a native oyster network in the UK and co-founded one in Europe. And in 5 years, because we were so purpose-driven, we have increased the number of restoration projects of oyster reefs tenfold in 5 years. Yeah. And the same is happening for seagrass. And now we're working together to do that for seascapes. People are amazing. There's so many incredible, talented, passionate advocates for nature out there. I have the pleasure of working with them every day of my life. But we need to socialise the concepts. That's why I'm here today. If we're going to restore nature, we need to restore our societal, financial, economic relationships with nature. There needs to be a psychological shift to an actual, real understanding that we are part of nature. We are entirely dependent on it. We have no hope of survival or flourishing as humans unless we restore nature. That is the bottom line. But we think nothing of spending billions on high-speed railway, offshore wind and gas, exciting projects, space projects. Why don't we do that for nature? It's what's going to ensure our survival. If we socialise the concept, suddenly people will have less fear and be more bold and able to take the risk of large-scale nature restoration. To do that, we need to professionalise. restoration and resource use. Conservation is a bit of an infantilized area of work sometimes. It's hobbyist, it's elitist. There are no decent paying jobs in it, I know. Why is that? Because we haven't socialized the concept. We haven't understood the urgency of it. So we need to build skills pipelines. We need a whole raft of people that can build hatcheries, produce billions of oysters, that can grow the seagrass, that can plant the salt marsh. We need proper jobs and pipelines and infrastructure to achieve this. This is our most important mission. We need to stop dredging the seabed. It's insane. America and Australia stopped it years ago. In the UK, we still dredge the seabed. It's been entirely flattened. It used to be this amazing 3D complex reefs. When they finished fishing out the oysters, they had to alter the charts because the sea got deeper. We've got relics of oyster reefs in the Black Sea, 7 meters high. We've flattened everything. And with that, we've flattened the basis of food chains. Now, we also are way behind in marine biology and conservation with the use of AI and technology. We need to really go big. We need automated underwater vehicles that are videoing the biodiversity, identifying them real time. I use environmental DNA to assess what's there. Those technologies are there. We can't be playing around with volunteers putting bags of seagrass seed into the sediment. We are not going to reach our goals like that. We need satellite determined models of where we need to restore, and then we need green underwater vehicles to go and plant all those seeds that come from the massive hatcheries and nurseries that provide the right seeds using the right genetic stock. This is what we need to do. We need to grow up and really take this seriously. And finally, everyone can say, well, we haven't got quite enough data. We haven't got the data to support the finance markets. People invested in oil until they really knew how much oil was under the ground. They guessed, they thought, they might. So we need to stop waiting. We need to restore at scale, then get the data to show what it provides. And that data will increase confidence in positive nature-positive markets. We need, in Australia and America, there is presidential orders and other things that kick-started large-scale restoration, and then they get the data on it. They get the amount of nitrogen that comes down. They count the number of fish. Everyone goes, oh, God, it's amazing. There's normally at least a 1 on 8 or 1 on 10 return for dollar in to dollar out when you do restoration. It has massive positive social economic impacts, as well as all the biodiversity, climate and pollution mitigations. And to do that, we need to bring together our climate and biodiversity policies and monitor them in the same way. But that's a geeky thing, doesn't matter about that. So my big policy message is we need to stop conserving and restoring little features. We're going to protect that little feature there, or that little feature there. You can only restore oysters on mixed sediment. I mean, to move away from this feature-based assessment, which is the Habitats Directive, to a spatial way of managing and protecting. So you protect a spatial area with the intention to restore the functionality, connectivity, and resilience. And that would free up a lot of the regulation and licensing. So that's all I had to say today. I hope you enjoyed listening. So hopefully it wasn't too technological. Thank you very much.
Okay, so Joanne's left a good amount of time for questions. I'm sure we've got plenty of really good questions people have been thinking of.
Thank you for giving us loads to think about. I'm just interested because you're talking about having to do all the bits of a wider bit of ecosystem at once, not just do one part of it, like say seagrass or oysters. You're saying we need to do them all at the same time in a given area. Is that, am I right on that?
Sometimes yes, so not always. Sometimes you just have to consider the area and then think about the order you do them in.
So, I mean, I live in Plymouth and I know we've got a massive seagrass project.
Yes.
That they see, but there's that they seem to have managed to scale up by doing mats rather than planting individual plants. But I've not heard a single thing about doing anything about oysters in the Sound or any, in the areas you were talking about when you said about historic stuff.
Yeah. It is in the pipeline. And I think the thing in Plymouth, there's actually been some natural recovery of some seagrass because of catchment impacts. They've stopped the amount of nutrients coming down. And so there's been some natural expansion of seagrass as well. And so again, it's about thinking about the whole seascape and the interactions. And so it depends on what place you're at. Somewhere like the Solent, you've got to do the oysters. You know, whereas somewhere in the Plymouth, you've got slightly clearer water and you've got some lovely kelp there as well. Well, 400, yeah, scientists are sometimes a bit slow on the uptake. But I think there's lots of people looking at Plymouth, and I think there will be. Part of the Environment Improvement Plan is to restore huge oyster reefs to 15% of English water bodies.
Random question from an amateur conservationist here.
Yes.
When you're talking about restoring habitats, how exactly are you doing that? And more specifically, do you mean by which species do you emphasize in the restoration? Do you start with the baseline producers and just hope that goes up?
Yeah.
Or just hope that, say, working with the like slightly higher up consumers, which then leads to the producers growing?
So it all depends on the environment. So if you're looking at kelp, you need to put the things back that eat the urchins, remove the grazing pressure. You know, when you want to reforest an area, sometimes you just have to cull loads of deer and stop the herbivores. So sometimes you just do that. So that's removing pressures. Sometimes, like with oysters, there's been such an ecological phase shift that they're not going to recover on their own. So you have to build an oyster reef to kickstart it. So sometimes you have to create tipping points, building from the bottom up. And sometimes the ideal is you just remove pressure and nature bounces back. But in Europe, in some places, we've degraded it so much that we need to just put some things back to create some tipping points. Does that answer your question?
Thank you very much. I have a vested interest in what you're talking about because I live on a boat on the west coast of Scotland. I have a daughter studying marine and freshwater conservation. You're talking about changing policy and changing the attitude of politicians.
Yes.
How optimistic are you that you can do that when it seems that the political environment is moving further to the right?
Yes.
With climate skeptics, with we're all living in a cost of living crisis, there isn't money enough to go around. You've got politicians declaring they're going to get rid of net zero targets and all that kind of stuff. And in terms of changing political policy, we can't even get a government to condemn a genocide in Gaza, let alone a genocide of oyster beds.
Yeah. It's a very good question, but people are very powerful. And that's why communities, if you get communities connected to governance structures, it really impacts. So we're advising the government on the Environment Improvement Plan, which is the UK Environment Plan, and helping them set targets. And we're helping them set targets based on our historical ecology work, which they never had done 5 years ago because that data wasn't there. So, like, as people know, oil, gas lobby so hard. And we don't lobby enough in the environmental sector. So we really need to get our lobbying act together with really clear single messages and say, this is what we want to change. And by the way, we've got the community together to deliver it. So community, get community together, get the skills, the evidence, the techniques, so you're ready to go and lobby at the same time. And those two things together, then it's massive step changes. So we're talking with OzPower at the moment to help them think about changing, going from feature-based to spatial-based assessment. And we've got the nature restoration regulation is in place. And so now we need the people to deliver it and deliver it in a way that is effective. So I think I am still hopeful because I work with the community people and I can see how when you get people together, you can lobby and you can start doing it. And when people start seeing the change, it changes their mind.
Hi.
Hi.
As in the middle of the land person.
Yes.
Who, novice, but is very interested and would like to contribute in some way. what are the hooks that I can start getting involved with, or the organisations that I can start being part of, or who do I need to write my letters to, or where would I start as somebody who is not coastal based, yeah, but actually sees it as fundamental for everybody?
Yeah. So I think the first thing is, you know, very easy support organisation that delivering these things. You know, it's also vote for people that put nature first. If you ever want to go by the coast, you can visit and you can get involved. But I think really it's using your voice, using your vote, and supporting both organisations that are doing nature restoration, and also thinking about where you put your money and your purchasing. I think that's probably the best thing for a landlocked.
Thank you. I'm fascinated by your description of changing baselines over hundreds of years.
Yes.
If we go back to pre-significant human intervention and look at the Solent, would the water there have been clear in the way that the water in Cornwall generally is clear?
It would have been much, much clearer. Much, much clearer. By around 600%.
Thank you so much. And I also just wanted to say your commitment to making really complex science really understandable has been really exemplary. And I think a lot of people just wanted to really appreciate that. But I recently read the book I mentioned last night. Vincent Dumizel wrote this book called The Seaweed Revolution, where he talks about all the incredible things you can do with seaweed for plastics replacements, for food, for medicines, for et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If we are in the process of rewilding the sea and putting back seaweed forests and those ecosystems, to what extent should we look at them as productive systems in the same way that a farmer might look at them? To what extent should we look at them as wild off-limits places in the way that nature conservation people might look at them? What's the balance between those two things, do you think? Yeah. Thank
you. That's a really great question. So at the moment, marine restoration and conservation is separated from all our marine spatial planning. And so restoration just be one tool in the box of marine spatial planning, how you utilise all the things in the sea, you know, the cables, the fishing and everything else. And so as part of that, we need regenerative aquaculture. Like the point about stopping dredging the seabed, that will help nature recover from the bottom up. And then we need regenerative aquaculture. So oysters, kelp, mussels, you know, all sorts of seaweed can be really positive and regenerative. It can absorb carbon and nutrients, and it can provide us food security. So I think that should be a huge growth area of skills and industry. And then that automatically takes the pressure off the seabed and allows for more space for nature. So it's an integral part of us. We're in an amazingly productive country in the UK. We're really lucky in terms of the nature around us, potentially.
Okay, Joe, you mentioned the fact that the United States has stopped dredging the seabed and taken other measures. It can hardly have escaped the attention of anyone in this tent that the current president of the United States is not a conservationist in any way, shape or form. In fact, his attitude seems to be that if there's money to be made in the US economy to be benefited by vandalizing anything, he'll vandalize it. And because of the geographical position of the United States, he's in a position to vandalize large swathes of the Atlantic, the Gulf of Mexico, which he now calls the Gulf of America, as if he owns it, mm-hmm, and the Pacific. Does that worry you?
Yeah, it really worries me. I've got lots of colleagues that are losing their jobs in America. There's lots of academics having to leave the Environmental Protection Agency. People have been sacked. America was leading the way in temperate restoration. They were 50 years ahead of us. Like what we do in Europe, we looked to America as the example. It's slightly different here, different species. They were actually a leading light in temperate conservation. And it's changing now. And Barack Obama had a presidential order that really helped the big Chesapeake Bay oyster restoration. So it's of huge concern. Yeah, it's wild and reckless, and it terrifies me.
Thanks for a brilliant talk. Wanted to ask, how much does successful restoration depend on ending marine pollution? Because you haven't talked about pollution so much. So how much does it depend on that? And do we know what to do about it?
Great question. So after seascapes comes wholescapes, and that's what we want to move towards. So when you're trying to restore anything in the sea, you need to look around and see what else is there. But you also need to go up into the catchments and see what's flowing down the rivers. And so that is very much any so the Solent Seascape project is in sort of has some active restoration, but most of it is about a big recovery plan to try and remediate and reduce the impact of pollution coming down our rivers. Now, it is a bit of a catch-22. We've always put shit into our seas, basically, in the UK. And actually, it's a lot better now since the tertiary wastewater treatment work in the sort of 70s. But now we've got all sorts of pollution coming through. So we need to lobby to change that. But also, if you restore habitats, they do a lot of the remediation. Like when there was massive runoff of nutrients from agriculture in the 1700s and 1800s, the oyster reefs that existed kept it under check. It's only when we remove the oyster reefs that suddenly we've got these really sort of soupy green seas. So it's it needs to be both approaches. And you need to, again, think about what are the most resilient habitats you can start to put in to create some of the tipping points, as well as removing some of the pressures. So lots of lobbying for water companies. In fact, landlocked person lobbying water companies is a really powerful thing.
Yeah, good morning. I was just thinking that I've been to various different talks. There's a lot of good ideas of what we need to address. But it seems to me that the root cause of all of this is basically short-term human greed. And how do we address the root cause? Have you got any thoughts about how to change the economics of this so that the profit motive is to restore stuff, not to keep damaging stuff?
Yeah. So I don't know if anyone went to Kate Raworth's talk last night. I'm a big fan of two things, planetary boundaries, understanding of planetary boundaries, Rohan Rockstrom's concepts, and also donut economics. So that's one approach when you can have continuous innovation within these boundaries. Most markets destroy nature, but we can develop a nature positive market. So that is one tool we need to use. But at the moment, they're all optional. They're voluntary. Most of like the blue carbon credits is all voluntary until they become mandatory. Everyone's going to avoid them. So making nature positive financial systems mandatory is one thing we can do. The other thing is we could dismantle neoliberal capitalism.
What do you think we as kids like could do to help the ocean?
That is a brilliant question. Thank you. The first thing, enjoy it. Learn to love it. Spend time in it. Because you protect what you love and care for. And, you know, it's your job to be a child and it's your job to play. And so go and enjoy the ocean, build a love for it, enjoy nature. And that's all you need to do right now.
Yeah, quite a few of the questions have sort of been more or less what I wanted to ask about. But it seems to me that scientists are using rational thought to try to decide what to do, but we are actually handing over all the decision making, as you suggest, to liberal markets, which are amoral and don't consider the consequences of what they're doing. All they're doing is looking to make a profit in the short term, and it just worries me that so many scientists seem to think that they will be able to persuade the markets and an irrational system to behave rationally. And maybe we should concentrate on getting rid of the system first.
Yeah. And both, I'd say. You know, we need to do it all. You know, I'm a marine biologist, so I do my corner. You know, so we need to sort of be, you know, do what we can do in our spheres. But I will say that there was a shift that actually it was a loss leader to invest in fossil fuels because of the costs of it. And that is understood by a lot of financiers as well. You know, there's obviously it's changed with Trump. But that was really understood on quite a global level. And that's why data is really important. When you basically, we haven't quantified some of these services, these ecosystem services. People thought, oh, it's quite good, but you need to quantify it. How many tons of nitrogen does a hectare of salt marsh remove and stop eutrophication? So the job for me and other scientists to do the experiments to quantify this, and then that can be turned into money, and then people go, oh, look, that has a really large value. So that there is, that's that work to be done as well. And so, but yes, we do need to change the systems, and we need to change the social structures, but I think we need to do both at the same time. There are good people working in finance, by the way. There are good people working in finance.
Hello.
Yeah,
this follows on from the question about pollution. So I'm a surfer, I belong to Surfers Against Sewage.
Brilliant.
What effect does the dumping of raw sewage, which is a lot of, stops me from surfing a lot, have an effect on your kind of proposals and your work?
Yeah. So it's making, well, it's stopping nature recovery. You know, it's putting so much nutrients in the system that the seagrass can't thrive, that you get this ephemeral green algae that smothers the salt marsh. In extreme circumstances, you get all the dissolved oxygen used up, and then the fish die off. There's a massive harmful algal bloom in South America at the moment. There's sponges and crustaceans just dripping off piers. There's dead fish washing up because of harmful algal blooms, which are caused by too many nutrients from runoff or poo in the system. So it can have really, really negative consequences.
Thank you so much. I've lived and worked in coastal communities, particularly kind of on the Yorkshire coast. You've kind of talked already a little bit about the fishing industry and how that's been a problem. I guess in politics, the fishing industry, particularly thinking about Brexit and stuff, was a big political football. When you talk about community restoration, is this something where part of the message is, here's how our coastal communities can thrive again through restoration projects and through, you know, is the fishing industry a helpful partner or something that needs to be still moderated? Or
yeah, so is the fishing a powerful partner? Yes, all of our work is done in collaboration with fishers. I spent 3 years meeting fishers in pubs before they'd start trusted me on the Stone Oyster Project. Restoration has to be done by the community. It has to have really strong stakeholder engagement, otherwise it will fail. In Wales, they did a seagrass project. They didn't involve the local fishers, and there was sort of outside in being done too. And the response was the fishers went and trawled through the seagrass. So, you know, and also they've got the knowledge. They've got traditional ecological knowledge. So it's really important. But also, we do need to move to sustainable fishing. So both is true. So we fishers help us plan where we put our oyster reefs because they know from when they used to fish all the oysters. And we use all their boats. We use the fishers' boats for our surveys and putting the oysters out. So it's a really integral part. And in Essex, the fishers have started the oyster restoration project. So you can have sustainable fisheries, but like dredging oyster beds is not very sustainable most of the time.
Do you think fish can be part of sustainable diets, and if so, how?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, well, first of all, bivalves, oysters and mussels are really, really sustainable if they're locally caught. I think with diets really can be really contentious, and I like to, it's a bit wanky, but I call myself a climavore. So what I eat will depend on where I live. So I don't really eat much jackfruit because I don't want a monoculture of jackfruit being flown all the way over to the here. But I will eat maybe locally caught fish and shellfish. So fish can be. There's not many sustainable fisheries left, but that's also because we've taken out the habitats that sustain the fisheries as well. So mackerel's pretty sustainable. Yeah, so it can be eaten as part of a diet. What is interesting, though, is we're not dependent on protein. We're not dependent on fish for most of our protein. So there's an amazing fishery scientist called Daniel Pauly who came up with the concept of the saline baseline. Him and his German colleague, Dirk, something or other. Dirk doesn't eat protein from fish because he wants to leave that to the communities that 90% of their protein comes from fish. So, you know, it sort of depends on where you're living. So there's lots of different arguments. But I think mostly plant-based, but you can get sustainable fish. It's really good for you.
I just wanted to ask, can we take inspiration from habitats like, you know, really deep sea that aren't very explored to try and... Can we take inspiration from those systems that aren't necessarily... we don't know as much about to rebuild ecosystems like where the UK has dredged the seafloors, so they're utterly gone.
Yeah. So I think the deep sea systems are different to the coastal systems, but you can take examples of the abundance and wildness and craziness of them. You can take inspiration from that. And the other thing I think is really important is, like, scientists are really, really poor at getting the messages into people's hearts. And I think what we need is we need more artists and film and song and storytelling that reimagines our relationship with nature. It'd be far more effective, you know. So I think anything in nature that gives you inspiration about how wild we could be again is a good thing.
Thank you, Joanne Preston, and thank you for your questions. Thank you so much. Thank Big you. Round of applause.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.